At the age of 15, when I was a junior in high school, I discovered Plato. Rather, a newly met school friend, and I was attending what was for me a new school in a new city. But this new friend introduced me to Plato. And that began a love affair with philosophy. It began to answer some of the questions with which I had been living since a very early age. 2 years later, as a freshman in college, another new friend introduced me to theosophy. And that casual introduction, and yes, be careful of casual introductions, has led to a lifetime passionate love affair that has consumed my life totally. Now, why have I begun with these two episodes? Betty first suggested that I speak on something regarding the book that has just been issued, which is really just a compilation of writings over the past 60-some years. And you can read the book, I don't have to talk about it. Whether you read it or not is up to you, it doesn't matter to me. But she suggested as a title, Theosophy and the Quest for Meaning. And I thought, so many people through the years, or particularly more recent years, I should say, so many people have come to me and said, have you ever written your memoirs? And I've said, no, that probably would be very boring. But now that I have a captive audience, although there is an exit here, I decided I would devote this talk to my memoirs. And if Betty feels that I have not fulfilled the task she asked me to take on, well, I still may appear next year. But I wanted to speak to something that was relevant. And I was very grateful when Sharon Doerr at the publishing house came up with the title for this collection of articles, The One True Adventure. Because really, the one true adventure has been my life. It is your life. And if you're involved in the quest for meaning, then I would like to share with you one woman's quest for meaning. And that's what I'm talking about. So to return to my 15th year, only later, many years later, did I begin to look back and realize that 14 years had elapsed since my birth. And that there is therefore a certain pattern that begins to emerge as one looks at one's life from any perspective. And you begin to see cycles, you begin to see events taking place in accordance with certain patterns. And 14 years is twice seven, which is a remarkable number in itself. And yes, it was the beginning of a new life in many ways. We had moved from the state of Ohio on the shores of Lake Erie in northern Ohio to southern Wisconsin, to a little town through which the Rock River flowed, Beloit. And the we that had made the move was I and my third set of parents. Now, some children go through shoes rather quickly. I seem to go through parents rather quickly. My birth mother died when I was 8 years old. And that immediately led to questions, a quest for meaning. What did it mean? What did death mean? What did it mean that I would not see her again? And what had the church told me about this? And so began that quest through a great variety of Christian traditions, Christian churches, who all seemed to have some kind of answer. It never occurred to me in that early age, of course, or in those early years, that there were other religions that might have other answers, because the world was just beginning to open before an eight-year-old. And so far as other countries were concerned, they were different colors in the geography book, which I'm sure is true for most of you. And so eventually my birth father remarried, and I was endowed suddenly with a stepmother. And if you have ever read stories of cruel stepmothers, well, I experienced that, of every kind of cruelty. I was always being somehow shunted to one side. And so it was determined that my grandmother's sister and her husband would take on the responsibility of looking after me, especially when they discovered the abuses to which I had been subjected. Which, of course, led to more questions. And the word karma was not anywhere near the vocabulary I was learning in fourth, fifth, sixth grade. And so my great aunt and uncle, who themselves had no children, decided to make it legal. And so I was adopted. And perhaps having heard what John Aljo has said about the word Mills, it became appropriate that I assumed their name. That is my adopted parents' name. So a year after my 15th birthday, my 15th year discovering Plato, a year later, as I was about to graduate from high school, my adopted father died. Another death. And the question still remained. So I began this adventure with questions. And what is an adventure? Now, without concern for its linguistic origins, Latin, Old French, and all the rest, which Dr. Aljo can fully inform you about, I suggest that an adventure represents the unpredictable in life. It's a movement from the known to the unknown. One writer has put it in the Grail Legends, to accept an adventure is to accept an encounter with a force which is in the proper sense of the word beyond the natural, an encounter which is always perilous. And that has been the story, in one sense, of my life. The adventure, the one true adventure, is one's own life. And it involves a couple of things which I have discovered as the years have gone on, and I'll intersperse some of the chronology, because I won't bore you with the full story of my life, but only a hint at a few chapters that might appear were it ever to be written. But one thing I've discovered is that there is a kind of unseen guidance, not an external guidance, but that if one really listens, if one really pays attention to even the most casual events, there is an inner guidance that comes very clear, that holds you true to that which you are to be. And to encounter that which you are meant to encounter. And so it involves another aspect, a willingness to trust. It involves decisions, whether conscious or unconscious. It involves being willing to stand at times at the crossroads and to consciously make that kind of decision that you know is the only decision you can make. And so I suggest, returning to my own story, that these emerged as the years have gone on. And look at your own life then. And how's that emerged? That knowingness that this is the direction. That interior guidance, not asking everyone else what I should do. What road should I take? Where should I go? Oh yes, of course we can ask. And we can ask those who are our elders, those who are wiser than we are. But ultimately, the guidance is from within. And we must trust that. Trust yourself to life, as one of my greatest mentors said, Clara Codd, and I'll come to her in a moment. But returning to my own story, the college years in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which were exciting and interesting, part of a young theosophist group. We had a wonderful young theosophist group in those days. David Bruce's father, Jack Bruce, was a very active member of our young theosophist group. And it was just before Jack met his mother, Vera Bruce. One of my oldest friends is here. So these, again, casual acquaintances who stand out. And as I say, because we were young theosophists, we were determined to know what theosophy was all about. We set about studying. And the first book we studied, and we really studied it until it was practically worn out of its covers, was The Key to Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky, which I was later to abridge for a Quest edition. But we were determined, and I'll tell you why we were determined. And that was because the older members of the Milwaukee Lodge looked rather askance on us young people. And I've always remembered that, and I've never looked askance at a young person since. But there was a kind of feeling that these young upstarts, they won't last long, you know. They come and go. They're really only interested in fun and doing things with music and whatever it was that was going on in the mid-1940s, early 1940s. But I began to recognize there are patterns in life. And these new concepts of reincarnation and karma, which were beginning to, what shall I say, tickle the edges of the brain. Fascinating. Of course, these are people I have met before. Now, we had one of the members of the lodge happened to be a speech professor in the college I was attending, which is, the college is now the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee. At that time, it was Milwaukee State Teachers College, and I was intent on becoming a teacher. There was only one thing in my life I wanted to do, and that was to be a teacher. My adopted mother didn't think much of that. That wasn't the best way to earn a living. Much more sensible to be trained for secretarial work and go into an office and so on. But I was determined, stubborn, I didn't think I was stubborn, I was just determined. My adopted mother, who was living with me during part of my college career, because my adopted father had died. But I began to see that these people had come out of my own past. And this particular member of the society, who was professor of speech at the college and became one of my professors as I took any number of courses on speech, said one day, I'll take some of you young people down to our national headquarters. It's only a couple of hours drive, isn't it, David? From Milwaukee to Wheaton. And so we came, and I saw this magnificent building. It was out in the country, two-lane highway, Main Street. And it seemed absolutely out in the country, of course. It was in those years, 1938 or 39, my first visit here. And I walked in and I thought, this is where I belong. Little did I know what was involved. But I came to realize that our circumstances are exactly what we need for our next step, for our growth, for our awakening. And that later that year, this is still before I joined the society, mind you, because I was living with my mother. We shared an apartment. I really couldn't, she didn't approve of that, which of course made me all more determined to study theosophy. A sure way to make anyone study theosophy is to have somebody in the family who strongly objects. It's marvelous. I should also tell you that the individual who introduced me to theosophy, some of you will remember the name of Caroline Tess Ross. Caroline and I were in college together. And when I first asked her, well, what is this theosophy? She said, we're not supposed to proselytize. And I said, I'm not asking you to proselytize. I'm asking you to tell me what it is. Well, we have to be very careful because we don't want to persuade anybody. I said, well, how do I ever find out what it is? So another way, to be sure to get new members, yeah, is to tell them, we really don't tell you anything. You have to find it for yourself. So I used to tell Caroline, she's passed on now, I used to tell her it was her karma. She got me into this. Anyway, later that year, just before I had joined the society, we had a visitor to Milwaukee Lodge on a tour in the United States in the society. Mary Kay Neff. Now, some of you may have heard of her, some of you may not have. But Mary Kay Neff had just come from Adyar. So far as I was concerned, she might have come from the moon. Adyar seemed, you know, some place foreign, distant. Where was this place? Besides, she dressed in a rumpled dress, and she wore sandals, which any proper lady around 1939 would never appear in, you know. But she had come from there, from this mystical place. She, of course, is the author of the book Personal Memoirs of H.P. Blavatsky, which is fascinating. She had worked in the archives at Adyar for several years, knew Annie Besant, of course, and so many of the great names. Well, we clicked. We absolutely clicked. Here was somebody who was willing to tell me what theosophy was about. Besides, I had been reading, and she was much impressed that I had been studying the key to theosophy, as all of our young theosophists were at that time. And so this opened a whole new world. And I accompanied her to the lecture, which was in a rented hall in Milwaukee. And I had no sooner entered the hall when someone in charge, perhaps the president of the lodge, came up and said to me, would you mind standing here at the leaflet table, giving out free leaflets? So I spent the evening giving out free leaflets, or being behind the table of the free literature. I won't bore you with telling you about my first meeting of the Milwaukee Lodge. That's a whole nother story, but that, anyway. So, in August of 1940, I took the fatal step. I joined the Theosophical Society in America. And my certificate was signed by Sidney A. Cook, National President, and George S. Arundale, International President. So now what was I going to do? Happily, my mother had gone to live with her brother in northern Wisconsin, and I thought, what am I going to do for the summer? I can't go home. I haven't any home, really. I could try to, this is just before my senior year. And so I thought, I wonder if they need any help. They seemed to need help in Milwaukee Lodge. They kept asking me to do things. I was helping in the library and at Mary Kay Neff's lecture. And so I thought, they must really need help. I've often said I finally joined the society because quite obviously they needed some help. whatever I could do, well, I'd be willing to do it. So I tentatively wrote a letter to Mr. Cook and said, would it be possible for a new member who's just joining to work at the headquarters for the summer? And the answer was an immediate yes. So although my official membership began on August 15th of 1940, I came to work at the headquarters in June. Well, what did I want to do? The one thing I wanted to do was to go to graduate school to get at least a master's degree. Now, Mr. Cook was the kind of very wise counselor who didn't mind young people around, unlike some of the older members of the Milwaukee Lodge. He welcomed them and believed that every young person should be given an opportunity. And so he said, well, if by the end of the summer you're not free yet, you have your final year at university, and if at the end of that you want to come back and work here for the summer, then we'll see about graduate school. So I did. I worked here for the summer, went on, finished my senior year, returned to headquarters to help during the summer. Well, with that promise that he had held out, and high school teaching jobs were very scarce in those days, I might tell you. So the few that I applied for, one was to even coach football, which I was not good at. Along with teaching English and history and something else, and coach football on the side, which really didn't somehow appeal to me very much. I like football all right, but I'm not for coaching it. So Mr. Cook said, well, let's see what we can do. Meanwhile, I had been offered a partial scholarship for my graduate work at the University of Chicago. And so he said, this is my investment in the future. Now that, I think, really was a crossroads. It was a turning point. And I have hoped that his hope for the future has been realized. But he was a remarkably far-sighted man in that respect. So I went on to the University of Chicago in my graduate work and completed the degree. And in June of 1942, again after Mr. Cook had called me into his office on one weekend when I had been visiting here and said, would you like to join the staff? He said, don't give me an answer, just think about it. And I said, I know the answer, yes. So in June of 1942, I joined the headquarters staff. They made me the correspondence course teacher. Now that, the teacher was all right, but I said, I really don't know enough to be a correspondence course teacher. And Mr. Cook said, well, then start learning. Well, the easy thing about that is that you can pretend, you can look up all the answers, you see, when somebody writes in with questions. You have time to, before you answer them, to look up all the answers, which is wonderful. So they thought I knew a great deal, but I really didn't know very much at all. That June of 1942, Not only did I join the headquarters staff, I was admitted to the ES. I was initiated into co-Freemasonry. Major steps. My life was set. And the guest speaker that summer, and our summer sessions were held out in the tent in the Besant Grove, a wonderful tent, all replete with mosquitoes too, in the evenings, as John will remember. Conventions were always in Chicago in the hotel and the summer school out here, you see. And the guest speaker that summer, he had traveled from Adyar through the Pacific War Zone. Remember, this is the time of the Second World War. Very much on our conscience. America joined the war while I was at graduate school. The guest speaker was C. Janaraja Dasa, Brother Raja, as we called him. He was not yet the president of the society. Dr. Arundale was still president. But Brother Raja came, and he had brought with him to place in safekeeping in London. This is before the days of the Blitz, although it was the time of the war. He had brought with him some things from the archives at Adyar, among which were the early letters from the Masters of the Wisdom sent to Henry Steele Alcott. These were put out in our, what's now called the meditation room, which we always called the shrine room. Don't ask me why, but that was what it was called. And to look at those letters, where the words fairly leapt off the page, words that seemed so alive, so vital, so calling to us, started my love affair with the Mahatma letters. Although these were not among that group known generally as the Mahatma letters, these are the letters that Mr. Janaraja Dasa put into the two little books, Letters from the Masters of the Wisdom. Well, so much for my being on the staff. The following year, Mr. Cook said to me, we really need somebody visiting some of the lodges in the area. And my first tentative lecture tours began. Michigan, Ohio, Illinois, and then a little bit further afield, Minneapolis and St. Paul. And in Minneapolis, an elderly member of the society, all these elderly members, now I'm among them, of course, but anyway, came up to me after my talk and he said, have you read The Secret Doctrine? And I said, well, no, it's a little difficult. I've been reading Besant and Leadbeater, which everybody was reading in those days. And he said, well, I'm going to write to Mr. Cook that nobody should be out on the lecture platform for the society if they haven't read The Secret Doctrine. So I thought, well, that's the end of that career. When I got back here to Alcott, I was trembling, and I said, Mr. Cook, is that over now? Is there something else I can do? He said, try The Secret Doctrine if you like, but you're still out on the lecture field. So by, again, one of those casual events, one of those interesting little synchronicities, I love synchronicities, there came across my desk as correspondence course teacher a little journal published by the society in Ireland, Iarnicon. It's just a little mimeographed paper at that time. But all of the sections exchanged, of course, their journals, as we still do, I presume, with all of the other sections, whether you can read the language or not. Fortunately, this was enough in English. It wasn't in Irish, so it was all right. And this particular issue had published in it something that had not been seen for a long time, if ever. Notes by a Commander Robert Bowen on what HPB had said to her own classes about the study of theosophy, of the secret doctrine. So I read that avidly, and I thought, well, it needs a little bit more to be said about it. And so I wrote a little booklet called Approaches to the Study of the Secret Doctrine, which Sidney Cook published. This is 1944. I think Nelda has a copy of it. But they're very rare. I don't even know if you have a copy in the archives. But anyway, it was a little green pamphlet, and Sidney Cook paid for its publishing. After all, the society had no money. Sidney Cook frequently paid our small salary then out of his own pocket because the society had no money. And so anyway, he had this printed and he sent a copy to every member in the American section, Approaches to the Study of the Secret Doctrine. I wrote it for myself, but he said, this is good, this better go out. So that was about my first published work. The next year, 1945, he sent me out to the West Coast, a tour of the West Coast, and a very interesting event occurred. And that was that he had received an invitation from the, what was always called the old Point Loma Society, the Theosophical Society, which had separated in the early days, in the 1890s, from the Adyar Society, but was now headquartered at Covina in California, Southern California, because Point Loma had been taken over by the Navy with the war. So Sidney had written back to the chairman of the board, Iverson Harris, that he didn't himself travel, which was true, but that one of our young speakers will be touring on the West Coast, and I've invited her, asked her to visit your headquarters and to speak on my behalf. So here I am, this young person, meeting with the Covina people, the Theosophical Society International, as it's called, at Covina. And I met Henry Edge, who was one of HPB's own pupils. Well, I could have listened to him, but they wanted to listen to me. And because they'd seen this booklet on Approaches to the Study of the Secret Doctrine, they assumed I knew it. And so they would ask some questions. Well, what did I think of what HPB said on page 319 of volume 2? And I had read the Adyar edition, which was 6 volumes. We're now back to the 2 volumes, so I wasn't quite sure where they were, let alone what they were asking about. But anyway, it set me off. So much for that. So I hope that hasn't bored you too much. 1945 came the change of the guard here at Alcott. I have to remember where I am. Alcott. I've spent most of my theosophical life, you understand, most of my life in theosophical centers. Well, came the changing of the guard with James Perkins becoming president, Sidney Cook moving on as vice president. Theosophical Society in America has given any number of vice presidents, I think, mainly because we're well known for the vice that we spread abroad. Sidney Cook, James Perkins, I, and now John Aljo. Before that, of course, there had been A.P. Warrington and William Q. Judge and so on. So we've had a lot of vice presidents. I don't know what that tells you about the American section, but anyway, there we are. So with Jim Perkins becoming president, the war ending, and Jim, a visionary, tremendous visionary, now to rebuild the section, to start anew. And so he inaugurated a program known as Spotlight, S-P-O-T, Speed Popularization of Theosophy, from the Mahachohan's letter. A spotlight program, and I was to spearhead it. And so Jim had to raise the money for it. And the first donor was Herbert Kern.
Joy, you should let me pop in and say that my dad started coming out here because I had such a spectacular time here. I said, Dad, don't just come for the
That's right.
new lecture, come for the whole schmear.
Yes, that's right. So there was Herbert Kern, and that, not knowing, of course, that years later there would come, 20 years later, would come the Kern Foundation, but the many talks with John's father and those intervening years and his dream of having high-class theosophical paperbacks, and that was our first venture with the Kern Foundation, was to publish paperbacks of high quality to present theosophy to the public. So you can see how casual events, Herbert Kern making that donation to the Spotlight Fund, as he made many other donations during his lifetime to the work of the society here. But that year also, 1946, brought another visitor, international speaker, Clara Codd. Trust yourself to life. And I kept saying to Clara, I've got to leave the staff. I need to earn a living. I have to look out for my senior years. I have to look out for retirement. I can't be a burden to the society all my life. And certainly what we were earning at Alcott in those days, there was no health plan, there was no pension plan. Our salary was very small. We had room and board, plus a little bit of cash. But Clara, who brought that magic of the childlike trust, that she exemplified, if anyone was Madame Theosophy, it was Clara, with an absolute, just a wide open wonder at life itself. I could tell you so many stories about Clara, and the endless cups of tea, of course, being English. She had come from South Africa, where she had spent the war years. But anyway, I went out on the Spotlight program. We initiated new lodges. We brought in new members. We went into cities where there were no lodges at all and advertised in the newspaper and sent out notices to people whose names we chose from the Chamber of Commerce lists, and gradually built up a number of lodges during those first 2 years of Spotlight program, when I would give the classes and over a six-week period. It was traveling circuit style, a different city every night, five cities, and then back to Alcott, as it were, sometimes, or to some center place, to Barbara Hebert's grandmother's in Covington, Louisiana. That was my safe haven. In the southern tour was Barbara's grandmother. and how she looked after me during the weekends while I recouped my energy for the circuit that was to take place the following week. Well, another crossroads, because I realized that I was speaking, but did I know? What is the experience? I had not really lived in the world. I had not really rubbed shoulders with people who had different views, other than on lecture tours, of course, but you're somewhat guarded. You're with the theosophists, aren't you? You're talking to people who are already committed, you know, like the story of Claire Booth Luce, who had interview with the Pope and began telling the Pope about Catholicism, and finally he said, "But madam, I am a Catholic." So it seemed to me that one needed to have some experience. And I was invited to live with two good members of the society in Seattle, Washington, as a result of my spotlight program in the Northwest. And so I decided I would leave the headquarters staff and go out to Seattle, and I was able to get a position in the Seattle Public Schools, West Seattle High School, teaching English and history. Exciting years, the rich experience of working with young people, doing what I'd been trained to do, to teach, and to work with young people and at high school level, which is where I wanted to be. At the same time, of course, there was Seattle Lodge. There was the rebuilding of the Northwest Federation, because I was immediately elected president of the Federation. And then a new experiment that we tried, that two members in Crotona, Grace Boughton and Ava Bowman, were experimenting with radio theosophy. And I said, we'll put them on the air, we'll put these new tapes on the air. And this was led to the finally the founding of the Foundation for Radio Theosophy here at Olcott. But this was an experiment also in getting together at the regional level. Felix Layton was the president of the Northern California Federation, and Lois Holmes of the Southern California, and we decided to have regional conferences. The West Coast Conference was born. And so these are not new, these regional conferences. They led on into national conferences that we had for several years. And so 1948 to 1955, 7 years teaching school until Jim Perkins came out to Seattle, personal visit to twist my arm. I have no one to be editor of the American Theosophist. I had to return. So 1955, back to Olcott, assistant editor of the American Theosophist, the Department of Education, developing our workshop training programs, writing manuals like Group Discussion and a number of other manuals, because no one had written them, so they had to be written, and there was no one to do it but I. In 1960 then, I see time is going, so I won't bore you with too much, but just some of the things, these casual times. Will you do this? Will you do it? Because it needs to be done. 1960, again, a change of guard. Dr. Henry Smith to be elected as national president. And he said, "Joy, I need you as the vice president." So I said, "All right, you accept." There's no other thought. So from 1960 to 1980, administrative positions in the society. First as vice president, then assuming the presidency in 1965, elected fully in 1966, with the Kern Foundation. And the one thing that I knew as I looked at that document that was on my desk when Henry Smith had vacated the office, and that in itself is a whole chapter in the story of this one true adventure, this one document on the desk, and I read it through and I thought, what we do will set a precedent for the Kern Foundation, its ability to help the Theosophical Society in America. We must be careful every step we take that it's in accordance with these requirements. And so I presented to the board the idea. I said, long talks with Herbert Kern have convinced me that our first project must be paperback books that are high quality at a very reasonable price, presenting Theosophy. This was Herbert Kern's dream because he had worked for it through the Theosophical Book Gift Institute. And so we began Quest Books, 1966, the World Congress in Salzburg, Austria, and the early days of Quest, getting Kay's books, not realizing the problems that were going to arise there. By chance, a ragged copy of the Dalai Lama's book, Opening of the Wisdom Eye, published in Bangkok, came into my hands. And I said to Helen, why don't we, Helen Zahara was my assistant, was my editor of Quest Books at that time, coordinator of the Kern Foundation programs. Floyd appears on the scene, of course, a wonderful, helpful. All of the people began to come that were needed. So I said to Helen, shall we try to get the Dalai Lama's book? And through the Tibet office, we were able to get the copyright. And that led to our traveling via the permission of the Tibet office and all the arrangements made in 1972 to travel to Dharamsala on our way to Adyar to meet His Holiness the Dalai Lama and have private interview with him. This is before he had come to the West. And of course he was our speaker at the 1975 convention in Adyar, and since then has, of course, visited the West many times. But this was before then. And you know what it's like to sit in a nice little comfortable lounge with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. 1972, December. Helen and I had traveled by train to Pathankot from Delhi and by car up to Dharamsala in the hill station. And to sit there, and Helen said, you know, it was H.P. Blavatsky who introduced Buddhism to the West. And so he said, oh, what did she write? And so I said, The Voice of the Silence is said to be a Buddhist text. And he looked right at me and he said, and what is the essence of the Voice of the Silence? Not an easy question to answer. So I stumbled around, tongue-tied almost, and finally said, well, it speaks of the Paramita's path. Then it is authentic, then it is authentic. All excitement. Well, 1967 had been my first trip to Adyar. And then came the building of the TPH building, convincing the board of directors that there had to be a building. John Sellen storming into my office and saying, Joy, you know we have no money. What are you thinking about? We can't use the Kern grant for that. What do you think you're going to do? How are you going to pay for that building? I said, I'm going to raise the money, John. And before I left office, it was debt-free. We had to have that building. And so the years have gone on, and the questions have remained. Always the challenge. Answers? The answers are not outside. If you are looking for meaning, there is a pattern in your life. Look at that. There are cycles in your lives. Look at that. Yes, there is karma, but karma is creative. It is not out of the past. It is transformed into dharma, which pulls you always inexorably to the future, to the next step that must be taken. And so it was to Adyar as vice president under John Coates. Leaving the known, I had no idea how long I would be at Adyar. I had no home. This had been my home. But the tradition was that when you left the staff, you left with everything. Nothing was to be left behind. And so my good friend Virginia Hansen, my colleague here during my presidency, took the things that I'd had to leave somewhere with her to Crotona. And so then the move to Crotona and the opportunity to take on the School of Theosophy and again to work with the Kern Foundation to see what we could do with helping the Crotona Institute of Theosophy measure up to the challenge that was before it, what we could do with what then was called the Happy Valley School, which is mentioned in the Kern Foundation Trust Agreement. Now it's called the Besant Hill School. And so my years of administrative work, 1960 to 1980, were at a close. Teaching years began. And then the years in Australia, the challenge there of becoming the national president, the first one to hold that title, as I was the first woman to hold the title of national president in the American section. Can you believe it that after 80 years, it took the American section 80 years to elect a woman? And I was the first woman. Have I found meaning? There are still questions. There are patterns. And the question that a friend asked me recently, what motivates me? What has driven me onwards through the years? That passionate love affair with theosophy. And I still have work to do. I'm not bowing out yet. But this is the quest for meaning. Never give up the quest. And I'm so grateful to the publishing house for putting this bookmark in our pamphlets, because it, in our folders, because it says exactly what I wanted to say by one of my favorite poets, Rainer Maria Rilke, the great German poet. Live your questions now, and perhaps even without knowing it, you will live along some distant day into your answers. And it is a living on. And so that is one woman's quest for meaning. A rich life. Clara Codd has taken that title, so rich a life. So if I ever write it, it's a privileged life. And I thank all of you. And I thank the Theosophical Society from the depths of my heart. You have given me a life. You have given me more than I can ever repay. And I'm endlessly grateful, endlessly grateful. And I thank all of you deeply.